From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Destruction of Smith by Algernon Blackwood. 10 years ago in the western states of America, I once met Smith, but he was no ordinary member of the Klan. He was Ezekiel B. Smith of Smithville. He was Smithville, for he founded it and made it live. It was in the oil region, where towns spring up on the map in a few days, like mushrooms, and may be destroyed again in a single night by fire and earthquake. On a hunting expedition, Smith stumbled upon a natural oil well and instantly staked his claim. A few months later, he was rich, grown into affluence as rapidly as that patch of wilderness grew into streets and houses where you could buy anything from an evening's gambling to a tin of Boston baked pork and beans. Smith was really a tremendous fellow, a sort of human dynamo of energy and pluck, with rare judgment in his great square head, the kind of judgment that in higher walks of life makes statesmen. His personality cut through the difficulties of life with a clean, easy force of putting his whole life into anything he touched. God's own luck, his comrades called it, but really it was sheer ability and character and personality. The man had power. From the moment of that oil find, his rise was very rapid, but while his brains went into a dozen other big enterprises, his heart remained in Little Smithville, the flimsy mushroom town he had created. His own life was in it. It was his baby. He spoke tenderly of its hideousness. Smithville was an intimate expression of his very self. Ezekiel B. Smith, I saw once only for a few minutes, but I have never forgotten him. It was the moment of his death, and we came across him on a shooting trip where the forests melt away towards the vast plains of the Arizona desert. The personality of the man was singularly impressive. I caught myself thinking of a mountain whereof some elemental force of nature so sure of itself that hurry is never necessary. And his gentleness was like the gentleness of women. Great strength often, the greatest always, has tenderness in it, a depth of tenderness unknown to pettier life. Our meeting was coincidence, for we were hunting in a region where distances are measured by hours, and the chances of running across white men very rare. For many days, our nightly camps were pitched in spots of beauty, where the loneliness is akin to the loneliness of the Egyptian desert. On one side, the mountain slopes were smothered with dense forest, hiding wee meadows of sweet grass like English lawns, and the other side stretching for more miles than a man can count, ran the desolate alkali plains of Arizona, where tufts of sagebrush are the only vegetation till you reach the lips of the Colorado canyons. Our horses were tethered for the night beneath the stars. Two backwoodsmen were cooking dinner. Smell of bacon over a wood fire mingled with a keen and fragrant air, when suddenly the horses neighed, signaling the approach of one of their own kind. Indians, white men, probably another hunting party, were within scenting distance, though it was long before my city ears caught any sound, and so longer before the cause itself entered the circle of our firelight. I saw a square-faced man, tanned like a redskin in a hunting shirt and a big sombrero, climb down slowly from his horse and move towards us, keenly searching with his eyes, and at the same time, Hank looked up from the frying pan where the bacon and venison sputtered in a pool of pork fat, exclaimed, "Why, it's Ezekiel B." The next words addressed to Jake, who held the kettle, were below his breath. "And if he ain't all broke up, just look at the eyes on him." I saw what he meant, the face of a human being distraught by some extraordinary emotion, a soul in violent distress, yet betrayal well kept under. Once, as a newspaper man, I had seen a murderer walk to the electric chair. The expression was similar. Death was behind his eyes, not in them. Smith brought in with him terror. In a dozen words, we learned he had been hunting for some weeks, but was now heading for Tranter, a stop-off station, where he could flag the daily train 140 miles southwest. He was making for Smithville, the little town that was the apple of his eye. Something was wrong with Smithville. No one asked him what. It is a custom to wait till information is volunteered. But Hank, helping him presently to venison, which he hardly touched, said casually, "Good hunting, boss. Your way?" And the brief reply told much, and proved how eager he was to relieve his mind by speech. "I'm glad to locate your camp, boys," he said. "That's luck. There's something going wrong." And a catch came into his voice. "With Smithville." Behind his laconic statement emerged somehow the terror the man experienced. For Smith to confess cowardice and in the same breath admit mere luck was equivalent to the hysteria that makes city people laugh or cry. It was genuinely dramatic. I have seen nothing more impressive by way of human tragedy, though hard to explain why, than this square-jawed, dauntless man sitting there with a firelight on his rugged features and saying this simple thing. For how in the world could he know it? In the pause that followed, his Indians came gliding in, tethered the horses, and sat down without a word to eat what Hank distributed. But nothing was to be read on their impassive faces. Redskins, whatever they may feel, show little. Then Smith gave us another pregnant sentence. "They heard it too," he said in a lower voice, indicating the three men. "They saw it just as I did." He looked up into the starry sky a second. "It's hard upon our trail right now," he added, as though he expected something to drop upon us from the heavens. And from that moment, I swear, we all felt creepy. The darkness round our lonely camp hid terror in its folds. The wind that whispered through the dry sagebrush brought whispers and the shuffle of watching figures. And when the Indians went softly out to pitch the tents and get more wood for the fire, I remember feeling glad the duty was not mine. Yet this feeling of uneasiness is something one rarely experiences in the open. It belongs to houses, overwrought imaginations, and the presence of evil men. Nature gives peace and security. That we all felt it proves how real it was. And Smith, who felt it most, of course, had brought it. "There's something gone wrong with Smithville," was an ominous statement of disaster. He said it just as a man in civilized lands might say, "My wife is dying. A telegram's just come. I must take the train." But how he felt so sure of it, 1,000 miles away, in this uninhabited corner of the wilderness, made us feel curiously uneasy. For it was an incredible thing, yet true. We all felt that. Smith did not imagine things. A sense of gloomy apprehension settled over our lonely camp, as though things were about to happen. Already they stalked across the great black night, watching us with many eyes. The wind had risen, and there were sounds among the trees. I, for one, felt no desire to go to bed. The way Smith sat there, watching the sky and peering into the sheet of darkness that veiled the desert, set my nerves all jangling. He expected something, but what? It was following him across this trackless wilderness, apparently above him against the brilliant stars. Something was hard upon his trail. Then, in the middle of painful silences, Smith suddenly turned loquacious, further sign with him of deep mental disturbance. He asked questions like a schoolboy, asked them of me too, as being an educated man. But there were such queer things to talk about in an Arizona campfire that Hank clearly wondered for his sanity. He knew about the wilderness madness that attacks some folks. He let his green cigar go out and flashed me signals to be cautious. He listened intently, with the eyes of a puzzled child, half cynical, half touched with superstitious dread. For briefly Smith asked me what I knew about stories of dying men appearing at a distance to those who loved them much. He had read about such tales, heard tell of them, but are they dead true, or are they just little fairy tales? I satisfied him as best I could with one or two authentic stories. Whether he believed or not, I cannot say, but his swift mind jumped in a flash to the point. "Then if that kind of stuff is true," he said, asked simply, "looks as though a feller had a duplicate of himself, spirit maybe, that gets loose and active at the time of death and heads straight for the part it loves best. Ain't that so, boss?" I admitted the theory was correct, and then he startled us with a final question that made Hank drop an oath below his breath, sure evidence of uneasy excitement in the old backwoodsman. Smith whispered it, looking over his shoulder into the night. "Ain't it just possible, then," he asked, "seeing that men and nature is all made of a piece-like, that places too have this duplicate appearance of themselves that gets loose when they go under?" It was difficult, under the circumstances, to explain that such a theory had been held to account for visions of scenery people sometimes have, and that a city may have a definite personality made up of all its inhabitants, moods, thoughts, feelings, and passions of the multitude, who go to compose its life and atmosphere, and that hence is due the odd changes in a man's individuality when he goes from one city to another. Nor was there any time to do so, for hardly had he asked a singular question when the horse whinnied. The Indians leaped to their feet as if ready for an attack, and Smith himself turned the color of the ashes that lay in a circle of whitish gray about the burning wood. There was an expression in his face of death, or as the Irish peasants say, destroyed. "That's Smithville," he cried, springing to his feet, then tottering so that I thought he must fall into the flame. "That's my baby town. Got loose in hunting for me, who made it and love it better than anything on God's green earth." And then he added with a kind of gulp in his throat, as of a man who wanted to cry but couldn't. "And it's going to bits. It's dying. And I'm not there to save it." He staggered and I caught his arm. The sound of his frightened, anguished voice and the shuffling of our many feet among the stones died away into the night. We all stood staring. The darkness came up closer. The horses ceased their whinnying. For a moment, nothing happened. Then Smith turned slowly round and raised his head towards the stars as though he saw something. "Hear that?" he whispered. "It's coming up close. That's what I've been hearing now, on and off, 2 days and nights. Listen!" His whispering voice broke horribly. The man was suffering atrociously. For a moment he became vastly, horribly animated, then stood still as death. But in the hollow silence, broken only by the sighing of the wind among the spruces, we at first heard nothing. Then, most curiously, something like rapid driven mist came trooping down the sky and veiled a group of stars. With it, as from an enormous distance, but growing swiftly nearer, came noises that were beyond all question the noises of a city rushing through the heavens. From all sides they came, and with them there shot a reddish streaked appearance across the misty veil that swung so rapidly and softly between the stars and our eyes. Lurid it was, and in some way terrible, a sense of helpless bewilderment came over me, scattering my faculties as in scenes of fire. when the mind struggles violently to possess itself and act for the best. Hank, holding his rifle ready to shoot, moves stupidly round the group, equally at a loss and swearing incessantly below his breath, for this overwhelming certainty that something living had come upon us from the sky possessed us all, and I personally felt as if a gigantic being swept against me through the night, destructive and enveloping, and yet that it was not one, but many. Power of action left me. I could not even observe with accuracy what was going on. I stared, dizzy and bewildered in all directions, but my power of movement was gone, and my feet refused to stir. Only I remember that the redskins stood like figures of stone, unmoved. And the sounds about us grew into a roar. This distant murmur came past us like a sea. There was a babble of shouting. Here in the deep old wilderness that knew no living human beings for hundreds of leagues, there was a tempest of voices calling, crying, shrieking, men's horses clamoring and the high screaming of women and children. Behind it ran a booming sound like thunder, yet all of it, while apparently so close above our heads, seemed in some inexplicable way far off in the distance, muted, faint, thinning out among the quiet stars. More like a memory of turmoil and tumult, it seemed, in the actual uproar heard at first hand. And through it ran the crash of big things, tumbling, breaking, falling in destruction with an awful detonating thunder of collapse. I thought the hills were toppling down upon us, a shrieking city, it seemed, fled past us through the sky. How long it lasted, it is impossible to say, for my power of measuring time had utterly vanished. A dreadful wild anguish summed up all the feelings I can remember. It seemed I watched, or read, or dreamed some desolating scene of disaster in which human life went overboard wholesale, as though one threw a hatful of insects into a blazing fire. This idea of burning, of thick suffocating smoke and savage flame, colored the entire experience. And the next thing I knew was that it had passed away as completely as though it had never been at all. The stars shone down from an air of limpid clearness, and there was a smell of burning leather in my nostrils. I just stepped back in time to save my feet. I had moved in my excitement against a circle of hot ashes. Hank pushed me back roughly with the barrel of his rifle. But strangest of all, I understood, as by some flash of divine intuition, the reason of this abrupt cessation of the horrible tumult. The personality of the town, set free and loosened in the moment of death, had returned to him who gave it birth, who loved it, and of whose life it was actually an expression. The being of Smithville was literally a projection, an emanation of the dynamic, vital personality of its puissant creator. And in death, it had returned on him with a shock of an accumulated power impossible for a human being to resist. For years he had provided it with life, but gradually it now rushed back to its source, thus concentrated in a single terrific moment. "That's him," I heard a voice saying from a great distance, as it seemed. "He's fired his last shot." I saw Hank turning the body over with his rifle butt. And though the face itself was calm beneath the stars, there was an attitude of limbs and body that suggested the bursting of an enormous shell that had twisted every fiber by its awful force, yet somehow left the body as a whole intact. We carried it to Tranter, and at the first real station along the line, we got the news by telegraph. Smithville wiped out by fire. Burned 2 days and nights. Loss of life 3,000. And all the way in my dreams, I seem still to hear that curious, dreadful cry of Smithville. The shrieking city, rushing headlong through the sky.